regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Hannah Hill, who is the Vice President for the National Foundation for Gun Rights. If you are active on social media and you like what Washington Gun Laws William Kirk does, you may have seen over the past few weeks Hannah and Costas Moros joining William on Monday mornings. William's getting up bright and early, and Costas too, out there on the West Coast, to basically do a live stream as the Supreme Court orders are coming out, in the hopes that there's going to be some good news for gun owners. We have not seen that. Getting back to kind of what we talked about with Mark Walters yesterday, we haven't seen terrible news. We haven't seen the denial of cert in these hardware ban cases. We have seen denial of cert, though, in cases like Melinda Vincent, the woman who lost her gun rights after writing a bad check for $400. Supreme Court hung on to her case for several months, but then ultimately denied cert. That's been frustrating. It has been very frustrating to see these hardware cases in a holding pattern, but the thinking, rightly or wrongly, because we don't know what the justices are thinking, but the thinking among court watchers is that the justices are hanging on to these gun and magazine ban cases until we get a decision from the Third Circuit. They could release their opinion any day now. I mean, the oral arguments in New Jersey's gun and magazine ban case held last October, I believe it was. And the makeup of the Third Circuit, this is an en banc panel, right? So is every judge on the Third Circuit. The makeup of the Third Circuit is, we believe now, to be pro-Second Amendment in nature. And if the court rules that New Jersey's gun and magazine ban violates the Second Amendment, then all of a sudden you've got that circuit court split. And that seems to be what the court is looking for in most cases, particularly when it comes to Second Amendment issues. I say most because, like, Wolford versus Lopez, dealing with the vampire rule, I guess there was a circuit court split because the Ninth Circuit upheld Hawaii's vampire rule. Second Circuit rejected New York's vampire rule. I believe the Fourth Circuit rejected Maryland's vampire rule. So, yeah, even there you've got a circuit court split. But that really does seem to be what the court's looking for, right? That there's some sort of conflict among the lower courts that the Supreme Court then has to step in and adjudicate. And unfortunately, we haven't had that in these hardware ban cases up to this point, because most of these states, I mean, there are only, I think right now, 11 states that have bans on so-called assault weapons. Virginia is going to be number 12 later this year. But, you know, most of these states are clustered in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So there hasn't been a lot of a 10th Circuit, I guess. Not even 10th Circuit, because Colorado has their permit to purchase law. So there have not been a lot of opportunities for the appellate courts to weigh in. And there haven't been a lot of opportunities for circuit court splits to be created. But it does look like one, I think, is likely to happen when the Third Circuit issues its decision in Cheeseman. That's the challenge to New Jersey's gun and magazine ban case. I think there are actually two lawsuits, but I'm blanking on the second name. Apologies. So today we talk with Hannah about these hardware ban cases and maybe even what the future looks like if the Supreme Court were to strike down these gun bans, because we know that the gun control lobby is not going to pack up and go home. Okay, fine. We can't ban handguns, and now we can't ban assault weapons, so there's no point in doing this anymore. That's not going to happen, right? It's wishful thinking. If you think that the Supreme Court striking down a ban on so-called assault weapons or large-capacity magazines is going to end the gun control lobby forever and ever. It's not. They will retrench. They will recalibrate. They may try to reinvent themselves once again, right, from gun control to gun safety to who knows what they'll call themselves next. But they're not going to go away. And they are still going to try to chip away at our right to keep our arms however they can, with the goal of one day eradicating those rights altogether. So it's a great conversation with Hannah Hill. I really appreciate her joining us. It is great to be able to talk to a new face here on the Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Looking forward to continuing the conversation in the future. But take a look and a listen. Hannah, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's really good to see you.
Good to see you, Cam. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Well, listen, you know, William Kirk has been having a lot of fun. I've been watching the Monday morning roundup with you and William and Costas, and I thought, you know, I've never had Hannah on the program. I need to rectify that. So I appreciate you joining us. And yeah, yesterday was another, I guess, disappointing Monday, right?
You know what, though? I'm a very proud South Carolinian, and our state motto is, while I breathe, I hope. And honestly, you know, when the Supreme Court says no, that sets a whole avalanche in motion. The downstream effects, especially that we see in the deep blue states, is it's open season on the Second Amendment. So, you know, any day that they don't reject us is a day that pushes all of that back further, even if it is inevitable. And time's on our side, you know. The longer we wait, the more pressing the issue becomes, and the more time we give for other cases to come up that are going to present the Supreme Court with a circuit split, which makes it even more inexcusable to dodge the issue. I think they know. They know they're going to have to take it sometime soon. I don't know if it'll be this year. It may be next year. But yeah, I'm firmly in the camp now that no news is good news.
Well, absolutely. When it comes to, you know, look, obviously we would prefer to see a cert grant, right? But I'll take no news over a denial, right?
Yes.
Just a denial of cert. And it does seem like the court is hanging on to these hardware cases for some reason, right? Mm-hmm. They've been relisted in conference a number of times. Obviously, we saw that with Snope versus Maryland last term. And then, you know, 15 conferences and then a denial.
Very demoralizing denial.
Yeah, right. I know. Even with Justice Kavanaugh's, well, just hang on. Right. But you look at the legal landscape and, you know, the Seventh Circuit decision is out there. The Third Circuit decision on New Jersey's gun and magazine ban is out there. And that's an en banc decision that we're waiting on. Right. So, I mean, there is no other step other than the Supreme Court, unless, Hannah, we get a good decision from the Third Circuit and New Jersey decides not to appeal it, right? Is that a concern of yours at all?
Not really, no. Because I think on the other side, they're as ideological as we are. First, you know, it would be a solid strategy move on their part. But that is where you see the strategy going head to head with, you know, the ideological belief in gun control that for them, in many cases, downright religious. And, you know, in their shoes, I would do the same thing. I would fight even a losing battle until I, you know, there was no place else to go. So not really, no. We also have the D.C. ban that was recently overturned by the D.C. Court of Appeals. D.C. is absolutely going to the wall on that one. They are rabid. They're throwing a hissy fit. Their attorneys are. It's actually rather amusing to watch it all go down. So, you know, one of them's going to, you know, and the fact that you have two opportunities and the D.C. ban certainly going eventually, regardless of what happens at the en banc court. I think that makes it more likely as well. So if that's the case, New Jersey's watching that. They're going to be like, we've got nothing to lose at this point because D.C. is going to do it if we don't.
Yeah. And the Seventh Circuit case that I mentioned, too. I mean, I unfortunately expect the Seventh Circuit to uphold Illinois' ban. But if the Third Circuit, you know, if the Third Circuit does create that split, the split's there, whether or not New Jersey appeals it. Right. So at that point, even if they decided, all right, let's take the loss. As you say, they're sort of only delaying the inevitable. Sooner or later, another one of these cases is going to come before the court. And frankly, if the Third Circuit decision comes out tomorrow or today, and we see that split created, well, again, we've got those five cases that are currently in the Supreme Court that the court can act on. You know, I know that it's frustrating. I mean, listen, I live in Virginia, and I think every day that we, you know, see this in action from the court, you've got Democrats who say, well, they haven't stopped us yet, so why not go full speed ahead, right? We were able to defeat a very sweeping gun ban bill in New Mexico this year. But this is something, I mean, you look at Rhode Island, they've got a bill introduced that would basically say existing owners have to get rid of their guns, right?
And why wouldn't they? I mean, at the same time, Snope is the one we remember. That was the Maryland gun ban out of the Fourth Circuit, which, by the way, you know, Virginia's in the Fourth Circuit. So that one hit home for y'all as well. And really, I think is one of the many factors responsible for the avalanche of gun control y'all are dealing with now. And in Rhode Island, you know, Ocean State Tactical was a challenge of their magazine ban that was concurrent with Snope. So the Supreme Court denied both of them at the same time. At this point, if you're, you know, a gun grabbing lawmaker in Rhode Island, why wouldn't you go to confiscation?
Right. Because the magazine ban in Rhode Island required existing owners to get rid of their magazines. Correct?
That one, I don't actually recall. Did it really?
I'll have to go back and check, but I'm pretty sure that it did. Yeah, I think it kind of mirrored Duncan, but you know, and again, let's say it didn't. But I will go back and check, and I'll let the audience know after we finish the interview. We know that it's coming, right? I mean, we know we've seen this playbook, right? The original magazine ban that was introduced in Virginia this session, you had to hand it over, and then they quietly took that out, and ultimately said, okay, you can have 15 round magazines, not 10 right. rounds. As long as we're going to arbitrarily decide what a large capacity magazine is, we'll give you 5 extra rounds, you know, and this is, I think it's so troubling to see what's going on here because, you know, we can file lawsuits and there are going to be a number of lawsuits filed as soon as Governor Abigail Spanberger puts the paper. But I've always said this, and we were talking just before we hit record here, and you know, you made the same comment. It's so much better to defeat a bad bill than to try to challenge a bad law, right?
I made the comment to you before we started that there's nothing like working in the legal field to make you believe in the legislative process, because it is very, very difficult to overturn a gun control law in the court system. It's in many ways, it's like trying to shoot a mosquito with a cannon. Now, it is technically possible. Most of the time, it's really not feasible because of the number of factors that go into it and the sheer time it takes. And if you're putting all your eggs in that basket, or even if you're trying to set it up by, you know, some have suggested Minnesota should pass a gun ban to help us get that circuit split because they start, well, that kind of 4D chess, what are you paying for it? You're subjecting your people to a gun ban for the years it's going to take to do this. Contrast that with the system we have that the founders gave us, right? We elect our state lawmakers. But, you know, if you asked the random gun owner if he knows who his state lawmakers are, most of them would say no. Most of them would. And the districts, now there are some districts where the districts are drawn, you know, deliberately to make this difficult. But your average gun owner, typically speaking, you can't blame the district if you don't even know who your lawmaker is in the first place. That is a failure on your part to engage the legislative process. B, now, my brother is a former state lawmaker, so I kind of had a ringside seat. Before I worked in gun rights, I worked for a state watchdog policy think tank. So I kind of had a ringside seat to the way all this operates. It is far easier to scare them than most people realize. They are terrified of angry voters, and they think 3 is a large number. So it is extremely easy to put the fear of God in them. And the legislative process is designed to work with you to do that. So is your, you know, your local government, your city council, your county council. Now there are some places where the cards are stacked against us. When the numbers aren't there, the numbers aren't there. But gun owners tend to blame when it's really the fault of their own failure to engage the legislative process. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing in Colorado, the numbers have been against us for years in Colorado. And yes, we're seeing some gun control pass now, but it should have passed a long time ago. And why didn't it? Because we fought, you know, with everything that we had to stop it. And we're still taking home some unlikely wins. So, you know, at the end of the day, there's, you know, there's no way to save the voters from themselves. And you see that in New York. Mm. You know, if they're going to vote for a communist, they're going to get a communist. But we also forget the fact that, as the founder said, it was a small, tireless minority.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think that, you know, New Mexico, I think, is a perfect example. Mm-hmm.
Right? Exactly.
Democrat-controlled Senate, Democrat-controlled House.
Right.
And yet, and Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has been trying for her entire term to get a gun ban to her desk, and she has not been able to do so. And I think in large part, you know, you look at some of those committee hearings this session, and man, they played so many games with the constituents. You know, they would hold these meetings, you know, late in the evening. But you had people, I remember from one of the hearings, I think it was in the Senate, people were there for 12 or 13 hours to get a chance to testify. But they stayed, and that was a packed room, right? And that tells those lawmakers, okay, these are committed voters. This is important to them. This is something that they're not going to forget if I go against them, right?
Yes.
And ultimately, you know, that bill died, I think for a variety of reasons. Even the gun control lobby was like, this is too broad. We don't want this to go to the Supreme Court because we might lose. But you couple that with the activism shown by gun owners in that state. And I think it's exactly to your point. You know, Colorado, I think, is that example. We saw this, you know, I remember covering the recall elections in Colorado more than a decade ago. And that, I think, that gave Democrats pause, right? I think now you've got lawmakers that weren't around for that, and they're going full speed ahead. But even, you know, you can look at what Colorado did with their attempt to ban so-called assault weapons last year,
right?
It got watered down to a permit to purchase, which isn't great. It's not great, but
no,
but it is not what they wanted originally, right?
That's right.
And, you know, I suspect, Hannah, that what you guys are dealing with in Colorado with that permit to purchase, frankly, I mean, that's probably the next step if the Supreme Court does take, when the Supreme Court takes a hardware case and strikes down these gun bans outright. I think that's what Democrats are going to fall back to, is what they're doing in Colorado right now is, okay, well, let's make it very restrictive to purchase one of these firearms.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think they know that's the thing. Go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay. I think they know that the handwriting is on the wall. The gun bans days, the outright gun bans days are numbered. You even have Kagan admitting that AR-15s are more or less in common use in this, in a case that wasn't actually a gun rights case. It was the Smith & Wesson versus Mexico case. And to get that kind of acknowledgement from one of the key leftists on the Supreme Court would have sent, you know, struck fear in their hearts. They also know that, you know, it's only a matter of time before they can't actually pass a gun ban. So I think what you're seeing in Colorado and what you're seeing in Washington State with the very extremely burdensome permit to purchase laws, it's difficult to get an AR and it has to be registered and all of the rest of it. I do think that is probably where they're going next. And it's a diabolical strategy because under the Bruin precedent, it's actually rather difficult to challenge. Bruin, in some ways, there's an enormous gaping loophole in the Bruin ruling, known as footnote 9. And they make much of that footnote, basically more or less blessing permitting regimes, or at least not condemning them as long as certain criteria are in place. It can't be abusive. It can't be, well, but who knows what abusive means? Is it 5 days? Is it 10 days? Is it 30 days? Is it training? Is it 20? And here's the thing. How many steps of the process can you put between me and the gun? But if they're all small steps, it's death by 1,000 paper cuts. But is a paper cut abusive? Right. All of this is a very untapped. Yeah, I mean, there's no case law about this one because the Supreme Court just created that footnote, that loophole. And the permit to purchase schemes that you're seeing in Colorado and Washington State, those are designed, in my view, specifically to exploit that loophole. And yeah, it's you know, it's difficult to exactly know how to craft a legal strategy. And we haven't seen much of that yet. I think we're going to have to. We're going to have to start figuring that out. And maybe we'll get some guidance from the Supreme Court. We've got a couple of Bruin cases pending there now. My number one hope is that they won't water it down. And if they, and then maybe they'll even help. I don't know. But yeah, I think the permits to purchase are probably where it's going next.
I suspect you're right. And you know, I mean, again, you talk about footnote 9 and the implicit blessing of a permitting system. And you're right. I mean, Democrats say, well, okay, well, if you can have a permit to carry, well, you can have a permit to acquire too, right?
Right.
You know, I would love to see the Supreme Court come back and just say, actually, we were wrong. But I don't know that that's going to happen. So maybe as a backup, you know, what I'd like to see is the Supreme Court say, all right, you can have a permit, mm-hmm. as long as it shall issue, but it has to cover the right to keep and the right to bear. It's one permit. You can't saddle people with multiple permits to buy a firearm, to carry a firearm, mm-hmm. Multiple permits to buy multiple firearms. You know, no, it's one shall issue permit. It can't be abusive. And it covers the, you know, panoply of your Second Amendment rights. That's maybe the best we could expect from the Supreme Court. I don't know that we're going to get it, but, you know, I think that that would be better, certainly than the current system where, yeah, you got to have a permit to buy, you got to have a different mm-hmm. permit to carry. You know, in some states that requires extra training. So you're costing, right. you know, it costs even hundreds of dollars more. If we're going to have to live under a shall issue system and under Bruin, it looks like we are, then I think the fair and just and maybe, you know, historically appropriate system would be one where, you know, you get that one government permission slip and it covers all of your Second Amendment rights.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thought, and I see where you're coming from, that that would be an improvement in places like Massachusetts and Illinois, right. where they have it multiple.
I'm well aware it would not be an improvement in the vast majority of states, right?
But here's the thing that I want to point out about that. You bring up the shall issue regimes. Do you remember the time when that was the radical solution for the states to say where you actually had to get the permit? That has been supplanted by constitutional carry, mm-hmm. right? We have constitutional carry, which is no government permission slip for your gun rights, for the right to carry. No permit needed, open or, you know, concealed. Yeah. That is in over half of the states at this point. And so we've pushed the envelope further. And that's a good thing. We've pushed the envelope further to be more constitutionally consistent, really. And you'll notice, honestly, that in many cases, the Supreme Court is downstream from the state's policy.
Yes.
What is mainstream for the states eventually will become mainstream for the Supreme Court. And we're seeing that not just in the gun rights area. Look at how many years of pro-life activism it took before the Supreme Court repealed Roe versus Wade. For instance, just to name one example. So the fight to stop unconstitutional permitting regimes on the legislative side has major impacts down the road for the legal system as well. The Supreme Court does catch up. It just takes them a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, listen, Hannah, I don't want to take up more of your time. I know that you got a meeting here in a couple minutes, and I want to make sure you get to it. But I would love to have you back at some point in the future. I really appreciate you sharing your perspective today. And if folks want more information about what the foundation is doing, how can they find you guys online?
Our website's gunrights.org. You can follow me online at HannahHill_SC. That's where I basically kind of keep everybody up to speed on what's going on with the courts and what's going on with our own cases, including our challenge to the Connecticut gun ban, which is currently pending at the Supreme Court. It's one of the group of five. So that's why I get up and hold my breath every Monday morning at this point. But yeah, they can follow us there. And yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, Cam.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been a lot of fun. I hope we get a chance to do it again soon.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
All right. Thanks, Hannah.
Thanks so much.
My thanks to Hannah for joining us on the program. Looking forward to talking to her again very soon. Now, before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day and our recidivist report, let's talk about this for just a second. From city streets to mountain trails, your gear should go wherever life takes you. That's why at Modern Rugged Leather, every bag is handcrafted from premium, responsibly sourced leather. It's designed to look sharp, last long, and tell the story all its own. Every stitch, every buckle, every strap, reflecting timeless craftsmanship, and it's backed by a lifetime warranty, because quality shouldn't quit when the adventure begins. So whether it's the boardroom or the back roads, Modern Rugged Leather helps you carry confidence every step of the way. Modern Rugged Leather, modern style, timeless durability, backed for life. Life takes you places. Make sure your gear keeps up. Shop the full collection, and you can find yours today, maybe even one that looks just like mine, at modernrugged.com. Again, that's modernrugged.com. And I love my bag, but I got to tell you, they have all kinds of great options there at the Modern Rugged. In fact, you know, my birthday is still about 5 months away, but I'm already eyeing a couple of bags, letting my kids know that, this is what Dad would want for his birthday coming up. Anyway, modernrugged.com. All right, let's get to today's Armed Citizen story. Our good deed of the day, And our recidivist report, we'll start there with a story out of Houston, Texas, where the local Fox affiliate reports a 19-year-old is out on probation, also free on three bonds, and he is now accused of murder. And if the criminal justice system had maybe acted like this guy was accused of and committing serious crimes, maybe the man he's accused of killing would be alive today. 29-year-old Jamarcus Johnson was shot and killed on September 22nd, 2005, allegedly by a guy named Johnny Lilly, who at the time was actually under the supervision of both the Department of Probation and Pretrial Services. So go back a year before, a little bit more than a year before Jamarcus Johnson was killed. He was killed in September of 2025. Go back to June of 2024. Johnny Lilly sentenced to probation for burglary of a motor vehicle. Which I have to say is not all that surprising. I mean, we can talk about whether that's just or not, but it's not particularly surprising that somebody who, you know, burgles a car gets away with a slap on the wrist, right? But Andy Kahan with Crime Stoppers Houston says, while he's out on probation, he picks up another charge for possession of a prohibited weapon. He's basically carrying a illegally converted pistol that fires full auto. So he gets charged with possession of a machine gun. Now, a couple of things could have happened there. Local prosecutors could have referred this to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and he could have picked up a federal charge, at which point Lilly might have been held without bond, certainly would have been eligible for some serious prison time. Instead, it sounds like prosecutors kept the case local, and a judge granted him bond, even though he was caught illegally carrying an illegally converted firearm while he's on probation. So now he's out on bond. He's still on probation. And while he's free on that first bond, he gets charged with breaking into another vehicle. And he gets bond once again. Now, at that point, I mean, clearly there's a history, right? Not necessarily of violent crimes, so maybe you can't make the case that Johnny Lilly poses a danger to the community or the public safety, but you can certainly argue that, you know, he's not keeping his nose out of trouble and that the best place for him to be until he goes to trial on this first charge would in fact be a jail cell. Again, no allegations at that point of a crime of violence, but certainly property damage, impacting people's safety, right? Anyway, doesn't happen. Now, according to Kahan, while he's out on those bonds, he apparently was charged yet again because he was ultimately out on three bonds. But pretrial services also says, listen, we can't keep track of him. He's violated the terms of his bond at least a half dozen times. And still, no judge was willing to put Johnny Lilly in jail to await trial. Now, again, I am not one who believes that, okay, just because you get arrested, that means you sit in that jail cell until your case goes to trial. I don't think that's feasible. I think it's probably a violation of some folks' constitutional rights. But again, when there is a pattern here, and clearly in Johnny Lilly's case, there was a pattern here, the courts can and should step in and say, because you're not abiding by the terms of your bond, because you keep getting arrested, you keep facing charges, maybe you failed a drug test, maybe you're not showing up to talk to your probation officer, you're not playing by the rules. And if you're not going to play by the rules, then you got to go sit in a jail cell. Multiple opportunities. Multiple breaks given Johnny Lilly. And that's why he was out on September 22nd, 2025, when he allegedly shot and killed Johnson. So, again, this is maybe typical. And not just in, you know, blue cities, in blue states. But this is, I think, part of our criminal justice system overall, no matter where we live. Incidents like this take place on a far too common basis. And You know, I applaud Fox 26 in Houston for actually covering this. Because at this point, sadly, I mean, a lot of these stories are, you know, dog bites man stories. There's nothing particularly special or unusual about them. This is just the way the criminal justice system operates, but it's not how the criminal justice system should operate. And so I do appreciate the Fox affiliate in Houston once again calling attention to the problems. They actually have a series called Breaking Bond. And so they do this on a fairly regular basis. One of the few stations that I'm aware of around the country that makes this a continued focus. And I appreciate that because obviously we do the same thing here on Bearing Arms Gamma Company. All right, on to today's armed citizen story from the Memphis, Tennessee area, where a homeowner shot an intruder, according to the Memphis Police Department. This was early Monday morning. We don't have a ton of information. We do know that the suspect in question is a woman. It was just before 5 o'clock Monday morning. Officers responded to a shooting at a residence West Valley Circle near McLean Road in Memphis, Tennessee. When officers got there, they found a woman lying in front of the home. She had a visible gunshot wound or wounds to her upper leg. The homeowner told police that he was sleeping. He heard noises from the back of his home. When he went to investigate, he saw a woman who he did not recognize inside his home. According to WMC, the homeowner said that when the woman said she wanted to buy his house, that's when he pulled the trigger. Now, I don't know that alone, like that comment, would make you justified in using deadly force in fear of your life, great bodily injury. But the fact that, again, this stranger was in his home where she had no right to be, not there to deliver flowers, right? You can assume that. And Tennessee is a castle doctrine state. At this point, the homeowner is not facing any charges. The woman, on the other hand, reportedly experiencing mental health issues. She was taken to the local hospital in non-critical condition and then was subsequently taken into custody. The homeowner was not, again, taken into custody. We'll keep our eyes open, but I think this is going to be ruled a justified use of force on the part of the homeowner. And it's sad. I mean, again, if this woman was experiencing some mental health issues, again, we get back to the mental health crisis that we have in this country. And not just the number of Americans who are experiencing and dealing with mental illness, which is a crisis in and of itself, but the lack of care in the vast majority of the country. There are not enough inpatient beds for those who are in acute crisis. There are not enough outpatient providers. And I'm not, you know, I know we talk about this and I'm going to get people say, just overly medicated. I'm not getting into that, man. I mean, yes, there's a shortage of psychiatrists who can prescribe medication. There's also a shortage of counselors who can't. Throughout the entirety of the mental health system, there are critical gaps. So, yeah, if you don't want to get medicated, you don't you think that SSRIs are being prescribed too frequently, okay. But there's also a shortage in mental health counselors who don't prescribe medication, who, you know, again, offer talk therapy. There's a shortage there as well. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why one of the reasons why I object to red flag laws is because they're billed as a way to deal with mental illness and mentally ill individuals and people who pose a threat to themselves or others, but they don't. They don't. They just take away that person's ability to legally own a firearm and have a problem solved. No, you're not treating the underlying illness. You're not treating the underlying problem. And they're getting ready to, you know, expand the red flag law in Colorado. They're expanding the red flag law in Virginia. Two states that do have, again, critical shortages of both inpatient and outpatient care options. Tennessee, I don't think is much better. And this, I think, just again, another example of focusing maybe on the easy solutions instead of the tough fixes. All right. Finally, today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time will enable to do the right thing. some good Samaritans to save the life of a Louisiana man during a recent parade. The individual in question from Mandeville, Louisiana, a suburb of New Orleans, Ronnie Lytell is the gentleman in question. He was supposed to just drop off his wife, who was going to ride in a Mardi Gras parade in New Orleans. But one of his buddies said, "Why don't you stick around and watch the parade?" And he says that decision to stick around actually saved his life. So it was, I guess, the Friday before Mardi Gras. It was the Cleopatra parade. And, you know, New Orleans, I mean, you got all these crews that are putting parades in. They don't just happen, you know, on one day. They take place several weeks before Mardi Gras. Ronnie Lytell's wife is riding in the parade. He's downtown. He's hanging out with one of his buddies back in his Marine Corps days, a guy named Jules. And Lytell says the last thing he remembers is seeing the fourth float go by. And he told his buddy Jules, he said, "Man, I feel dizzy. I need to sit down." And went into cardiac arrest like that. Before EMS arrived, three individuals who were watching the parade jumped into action. They started performing chest compressions. Lytell's friend Jules was doing mouth to mouth. Lytell said that he had talked to his cardiologist afterwards, and the cardiologist said, "Yeah, you know, if those people had not been there, you would not be here." So Bill Samarin, who is the head of New Orleans EMS, told the TV station WWL about Lytell because the station was working on a story about an increase in emergency calls on the parade route. And so Samarin mentioned, like, "Hey, there was this guy, he had a heart attack, but there were people there who saved his life, and he's in the ICU." As Samarin had told WWL, he said, "I'd love to find those people who helped this guy, you know, because, I mean, again, crowded parade. Once the crisis was over, I'm sure these people went on about their day." So they ran a story. Meg Ferris, who's the medical reporter for WWL, ran the story, talked about Ronnie Lytell's experience. And she said the Good Samaritans actually contacted her, saying that they wanted to meet the man whose life they saved. They didn't think that he had survived. So I guess it was yesterday, WWL was able to reunite Lytell with these three individuals, Justin Bernier, Blake Hirschius. Bernier is actually a nurse at the local VA hospital. Hirschius served in the U.S. Coast Guard, and then a third Good Samaritan, Asher Babin, actually a surgical tech at a local hospital. So again, I mean, all three with, you know, experience, the education, the training, did not freak out, but just stepped up and acted when they needed to do so. They didn't know each other, as far as I can tell. Just three strangers coming to the aid of a fourth stranger who desperately needed their help and is alive today because of their actions, as well as the actions of his friend Jules. So in the right place, at the right time, willing to do the right thing for a stranger in need. Again, Justin Bernier, Blake Hirschius, Cher Babin, and I don't have Jules' last name, but all four of you individuals, thank you so much for looking out for a stranger in need. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest news and information from all across the nation. The good, the bad, and the ugly. I don't like writing the bad stories, but, you know, I wrote a story earlier today about a good pro-gun bill getting pulled in Louisiana, which is disappointing and frustrating to see, but you know, not going to sugarcoat it, but we do have some good news to report, including Bearing Arms contributor John Petrolino suing the New Jersey State Police, seeking records that the state police won't give him about just basic demographic data about the retired law enforcement officers who are applying for concealed carry permits in the Garden State. I'm glad to see that John engaging his bulldog nature to try to get those public records. We've got some good news from these states as well. And if you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member. Just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can take 60% off your membership. Now, no matter what tier of support you choose, you're going to get some great benefits. Obviously, they expand as you go to VIP Gold and then into VIP Platinum. But no matter what tier of support you choose, You'll also be supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms, and I cannot thank you enough for that, because your support is invaluable. Have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. I'll be on with Carl Higby on Newsmax in the 6 p.m. Eastern hour tonight. I'll see you back here again tomorrow for another edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.